Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have a great show tonight. Actually, this is the last time, I think it's 5 weeks now, that I've been in hotel rooms. And this is the last time. I'll be back at the home studio coming up next week. I'm pretty excited about it. Even though I'll be going back to snow, it'll still be great to be in the home studio and have actually more control to be able to do better shows for you. And we have some great ones coming up. And speaking of that, next week we have Kevin Day. He was on the USS Nimitz as the radar person. Radar operator. Thank you, Race. So I want to welcome everyone over at KGRA and on YouTube. And I want to also thank all the supporters of the show very much. Without you, we couldn't have a show, so I really do appreciate it. And our guest tonight is Earl Gray. He's in Southern California, and he's a musician, and his mother had quite an experience. We're going to be talking about all that and how he got interested in the topic, and he's also a MUFON researcher. And we'll talk about some California cases and you name it. Now, just a quick update here. Alejandro is a little under the weather, so unfortunately he's not joining us this week. He will be back next week. So I just wanted to talk quickly. I stopped over and saw a great friend from years ago, decades ago. He was my roommate, and I visited him. That's when I lived in Colorado many years ago. And so we're having a dinner time chat, and one thing led to another, and all of a sudden the topic of his mom was there, and she actually follows me on Facebook, and she says, "I really like the space stuff." And I go, "Oh, you know," because a lot of people will tag me in, you know, UFO related things. So, and I try to untag myself because I also have to maintain a professional for what I do. So I don't do too much of that on my own personal Facebook page, but it still gets on there. Anyway, she said she really likes that. And I said, wow, okay. So I started talking about doing a show on UFOs. And so Larry's wife, Renee, told me some amazing sightings that she had. She had three. And when I was telling her I did a show on UFOs, and, you know, some people think it's kind of out there and all that, and she, like, shook her head no, and then she started telling me her experiences, and one was really unique. It was something that actually came out. She saw lights in a tree, and it was an object that came out of the tree, and this is back in the 1970s. And then she had other encounters where one involved some police officers, and that was really interesting. They jumped in their car and left. They didn't want to talk about it. And then also she was at a campfire, you know, years later, and everyone around the campfire, no one was drinking or smoking or anything. And they had a great encounter as well, right over their head. It was just hovering right over their head, a disc-shaped object. The object in the tree that she mentioned, I don't really know the shape of that one in particular. She said it was kind of small, like the size of a table. The one that she had where the police officers saw it looked like sort of like a cylinder. So that's really interesting to me. And the latest one, the last one she saw, was more like a disc. But anyway, it was really fun to hear those stories. So that's it for me. Again, I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. And we're ready to bring in our guest. Earl, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Martin. How are you doing?
Good. You remembered to unmute. That's always good. So, Earl, I've heard your name a lot. And, you know, as you know, I help out Alejandro with his show, and he had you on a while back. I think he said something about a UFO researcher that rocks or something like that.
That was very nice. That was a while ago. It was about 2.5 years ago or so. But I bump into Alejandro. Alien Con, we bumped into each other. And, I see him at different events. So I always keep in touch with Alejandro.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Unfortunately, he's under the weather, but he'll be back.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, be back next week. And so can you give the the listeners never heard your story, your basic background, if you would.
Sure. Well, now I became a MUFON field investigator. It's coming on 4 years now, and in a couple of months it'll be 4 years. And the way that this happened for me, all my life I've been interested in extraterrestrial life and outer space. It's been sort of this obsession that I've had ever since I was a child. Now, some of that may be, unequivocally, is because my mom, back in the 1950s, she worked for Howard Hughes, the millionaire. She worked for Hughes Aircraft. She was one of his two private secretaries. The way that he had two secretaries that worked for him. He had my mom, and he had another woman who worked for him as well. And they would communicate. It was sort of like Charlie's Angels. They would communicate over intercom. Hughes at this point was a recluse. He was he just didn't like to have contact with people. He was a germaphobe. But he talked to my mom every single day. They actually became very close. In the years that my mom worked for him, she only saw him once. And the way that happened was he would leave at a particular time at the end of the day, and they would make sure that the little hallway was clear, so that he could go and get out to the parking area and not worry about being seen or having to deal with people or, you know, possibly catching their pathogens, apparently. But my mom was a little quick one evening, and she started going out the long hallway. And she said that it was very Chaplin-esque, that he was sort of at the end of the hallway, that he was opening the door, so he was, back, sort of lit by the, by the light that was coming through the end of the hallway. And she said he had his hat on and his briefcase, and out he went. So that was the one time that my mom actually saw him. But other than that, she spoke with him every day. She worked the office next door to his.
Wow. So she only saw him one time, but she worked for him for years?
She worked for him for years.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Now, my mom, she told me a very strange story. I must have been about 4 years old the first time that I heard this, where she talked about how Hughes had sent her out to the middle of a desert. She said that he didn't give her any real warning about where she was going. He just said, "I have an assignment for you. I'm going to be sending you out, and they'll take care of you, and don't worry." So my mom, they flew her out to the middle of nowhere, is how she described it. She never really told me what state it was even in, but she said it was the Great American Desert. And they flew her out, and she had a security detail, and she said that they drove up to this little nondescript shack kind of building. They opened the door to the shack, and there was an elevator shaft. And my mom got into the elevator with the security detail, and she said that it was very strange. It was there was nothing there. I mean, there was nothing there, just scrub and flat desert.
Wow.
So they got into the elevator, and it went down. And she said that it surprised her because it kept going down. She started feeling kind of scared. She said that she had butterflies in her stomach. So anyhow, they finally got down to the level that they were going to. And she said that it was an Otis elevator. That's the other thing. She kind of laughed at that. She said that it was made by Otis Corporation. It was just like you would find in a high rise, but it was going down and not up. So the doors opened up, and she said that there was a bustling little city, is how she described it, a little city under the desert. This was probably around 1956, 57. And she said that they got around in golf carts, that there were scientists that were working down there on esoteric projects, was what she said. I didn't know what esoteric meant when I was a kid. So that might have been how they described it amongst themselves. And Who knows? Maybe there was a program called Esoteric Projects. I guess I should put in a FOIA request and find out. But anyhow, she said that she knew Werner von Braun, that she had worked with Werner, that she knew him. She said he was a charming man. She said that he used to call her Betty Grace. That was her first and her middle name. And he would kind of call her Betty Grace like it was one name. And I guess my mom was kind of smitten by him. It sounded like it, because she kept bringing him up. If he was on TV on Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color or something, she'd go, "Oh, it's my old friend." But she said that they had a movie theater down there, a bowling alley, that they had a little French cafe with yellow umbrellas over patio tables. And she, my mom had a great sense of humor. She laughed at that, you know, because she said, "Well, you don't really have to worry about the sun if you're in a cave." And that's technically where we were, but this is the way that they thought and how they treated it. I guess that they wanted to make people feel at ease and at home and at comfort, even though they were a mile under the desert floor. And she actually did say it was a mile under the desert floor. I'm not sure. I don't think she was exaggerating. That's just the words that she used when she talked about it.
Now, on this subject alone, just a quick question for you. Was there a place like I'm trying to picture this out in the desert? I mean, an elevator has to have like mechanics above it. Where was the door to go into this elevator? Did she talk about that? It just sounds really pretty strange.
She said that it was a shack.
Elevator was inside of a shack.
It was like a shack. She described it. Now, I've recently found pictures of some of our missile silos from that period of time out in the desert. And that's kind of what it looks like. It's sort of a nondescript shack, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, 30 feet across by 20 feet across. And you would open a door and there would be a stairwell. But in this case, there was an elevator. It was deeper than I guess they wanted to take stairs to. And here's an interesting thing. I have one friend, a social media friend who had an email from a friend of his whose mother also worked for Howard Hughes. And I think that I may have found the second secretary's son. I saw an email from him directed to my friend from a couple of years ago, really before I started talking about this, certainly before I was talking about it on the radio. And he pretty much told the same story. Although this guy has a pension, he's an old RAF guy and does not want to lose his pension. So he's very reticent about talking about this. But it was kind of nice, you know, finally getting a little bit of corroboration. And I did see the email exchange that he had with this friend of mine, which went back a couple of years ago. But we know that the government builds deep underground facilities. They use a thing called a subterrane, which just, you know, it more or less can drill through the rock and melt through the rock. I know that oftentimes they would use actual caverns that were already there, mm-hmm. and kind of take advantage of that sort of thing. So it's not all that unusual that we have underground bases, but it's unusual that it was in the middle of nowhere, that it was more or less in the mid-50s, because you have to wonder what they have now. And the other thing that my mom talked about as I was growing up, and she would usually talk about it in a different context than when she was talking about working in the underground base with, you know, people like Werner and Oberth and those guys, was my mom talked about extraterrestrial life. My mom was not a UFO buff of any sort, but she said through the years she would talk about it with great authority. My mom said that the government knows that we aren't alone in the universe. She said they know. That's just a fact. They know this. And so I grew up with this knowledge that we weren't alone. And you have to imagine that that's always been this kind of a driving force for me to know more. Unfortunately, you know, my mom did have her security clearances, and she kept them till the day she died. I think that the reason why she talked to me back in the early 1960s and why she talked about this was because she thought she was finished working. She was sort of playing housewife and the Ozzie and Harriet thing. But back in the mid-1970s, she went back to work. My mom wound up becoming a corporate headhunter for people like Lockheed Skunk Works, Northrop, Boeing, Raytheon, just all the major aerospace companies.
Mm.
So she wow. clamped up. She seemed to talk more freely about it when I was little. When I got older, my mom clammed up about it. So it kind of became my trick was trying to hear a little bit more. Now, I took my mom to see Star Wars, the film Star Wars. It was 1977. It was the second day that it was in the theaters. And I saw an article about it in Time magazine. I was thinking, let's take mom to see that. Let's take mom. You know, let's see if we can find out anything else. You know, so it worked. You know, I mean, we watched the film. The lights came back up. We kind of sat through the credits at the end, and my mom was really excited. What she told me, she kind of went on this big spiel, and she said, "Earl, you have no idea. Star Wars is not that far-fetched." And I remember that word for word. She said, "It's not that far-fetched." She said, "We know that there is life out in the universe, and we're in contact with it, you know." And my mom went off on, she talked for a while. I actually got a little more information than I wanted at the time because I was in my life at that point. I'd become a born again Christian. I was sort of a church mouse, and I always believed that there was life out in the universe, but I didn't think that we had details. And my mom started talking about that they're here. And so I've had that knowledge for a long time. Now my mom became more closed mouth about it as the years went on, and I started asking her more pointed questions. I mean, I even asked her about Bob Lazar. My mom passed in 1999. Unfortunately, my mom passed away. She had a spate of multiple unrelated cancers. And so after she found out that she was dying, my mom became a little more voluble about this stuff. She had never heard of Bob Lazar, by the way. I asked her. Not that she would have said if she did know about him or if she knew him, but my mom, what I kind of tried to do towards the end of my mom's life, I mean, the doctors, they said that her cancer hadn't metastasized, that it seemed like she had been irradiated. And that same year that she passed away, there were some workers from Area 51 that successfully sued our government for exposing them to harmful substances. And right. they won the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And this is when Bill Clinton actually went on television and told us that, yes, there is such a thing as Area 51. And suddenly this mythical place became a real place on maps and everything. So I tried to get my mom to lawyer up because she had cancer six different times. This time it was in her lungs, and she had never smoked a day in her life. And I thought, they didn't really, it's not like we were rich. We were definitely a middle-class family. And I felt like, you know, they should have taken care, you know, better care of you, Mom. Her reply to all that was, she said, you know, son, I knew what I was getting into. I felt that I was doing my patriotic duty. I felt like I would, like a soldier would feel. I was doing this for our country, and I knew that there were risks involved, and I wouldn't change anything. And I'm certainly not going to sue my government. You know, I'm proud of what I did. And that was sort of the end of the conversation. That was back in 1999, and she passed away late April, the same month, like just a couple weeks after we'd had that talk. But it's always been this huge 50-foot question mark in my life. You know, what else did my mom know? Another occasion, my mom said, it's realer than you will ever know, son. And I think that the words, realer than you will ever know, kind of drove me to just disprove that no, I can know. I think that I can dig and I can maybe find out more than even you're willing to tell me here. Because she kind of gave me a teaser at age 4, and I lived with that.
Now, what... was there a certain branch of the government? Did you talk about, you know, I know you said she was, you worked with Howard Hughes and one of his personal secretaries, but would she also, she had an involvement with the government? And do you know what branch or what office she was involved in?
Well, I know that Hughes worked with, my mom was never a part of the military. She did have very high security clearances. I do know that. But she didn't mention a branch of the military, but we do know that the Army Corps of Engineers worked sort of hand in hand with Hughes. We know that that Hughes actually made his money from a drill bit You know, the early oil, bringing the oil up out of the earth, and he came up with a better drill bit, and that's really how he became the rich man that he was.
Yeah, I think I saw something. But I mean, she was probably a private contractor or
that's
involved
my guess.
With
she was never in the military. She was never in the military herself. Mm-hmm. And Hughes was a private contractor. We've recently found, I know that Richard Souter has written about this a little bit in his Underground Bases books.
Oh, yeah.
That one of the earliest labs that was at Area 51 was owned by Hughes Aircraft, that was one of the, if not the first, private contractor. So that, I think, probably has something to do with what my mom was doing. And all the scientists that she mentioned that she knew, they all had German names, so you know. I think that was probably something to do with Operation Paperclip. Is what was going on there, you know?
Yeah, really, really fascinating. So we're coming up on a break. I think we're going to go ahead and take that break now. So we'll be right back, everyone. Right after these messages, hang in there. Everyone, welcome back. Here we are. And before we start back with our guest, Earl Gray, Anderson is his full name. And we may even talk how he got his name, Earl Gray T, everyone thinks of. But I just wanted to say History Channel has just been given the green light for a show called Unidentified Inside America's UFO Investigation. It's going to be a 6-part docuseries that the network will say they'll talk about the U.S. government's secret program investigating the UFO phenomenon and all that stuff. And it will premiere sometime in May. And it has, people from, of course, To the Stars Academy. A lot of that's going to be involved in that. Chris Mellon is going to be involved. Everyone that, and especially Luis Elizondo, he'll be featured on that. So that's coming up in May. That's kind of exciting. So we'll have to keep our eyes out for that and check that out when it comes comes available. All right, back with my guest, Kevin. So we were talking. Kevin's on next week. I'm so sorry, Earl. Earl. So Earl, how did you get your Earl Grey tea name anyway? Is that just a nickname?
Yes. Well, my real name is Earl. All right, it's Earl.
I know that part. Yeah,
I'm like the TV show. You know, my name is Earl, but my name is Earl. I was named after my grandfather, I'm a musician. I've been a musician many, many years. I still do that. I have a gig tonight, actually, at a place called Nat Denny's Ale House out in Altadena. So if you're out here, folks, come out and see me. You know, it'll be we put together a little instant band for this show tonight. But around 1989, I was playing at a place out in Santa Monica, and I was going as Earl Anderson, my birth name at the time. And there was another gentleman by the name of Eric Anderson who played Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar. And we both played the same venue pretty often. And they messed up the marquee a couple of times. So I would get his audience accidentally, and then he would get my audience accidentally. And he did kind of, you know, full-on R&B. You know, he's a African-American gentleman, very, very talented singer. I mean, well, he was Judas and Jesus Christ Superstar. So I was, and there were some other things, too. You know, I was just, I was kind of hanging out in places where I was hanging out with people from the band X, and of course you had people in that band, John Doe and Exene Cervenka, and everybody sort of had a pseudonym, and so I started chuckling to myself, well, that would take care of the problem at my place over in Santa Monica where, you know, they messed up the marquee. And plus, it's a memorable name. I get free advertising. If you go into a coffee house and you look at the menu, there I am. So I went with Earl Grey as kind of a joke to myself. But you know, here we are. It's 30 years later, and my kids and my grandkids call me Earl Grey now. So I'm kind of stuck with it. But yeah. It works with the UFO thing, right?
Gray. You're the Grey.
Yeah. I'm afraid I'm not. I have a fear that I just don't want to scare anybody. You know, if I get their case and I, you know, dear so and so, I'm from MUFON and I've been assigned your case and my name is Earl Grey. So I kind of, you know, now I've kind of put the whole thing together. It's Earl Grey Anderson, and yep. Hopefully they'll figure out that I'm not really a gray alien. Correct? Yeah. But that's where that came from, Martin.
Yeah. And so let's talk about how you became an investigator, how that whole thing came about.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, this is something that's just it's been sort of in the back of my mind all of my life. And since my mom passed away, it actually just became an obsession to find out more about the phenomena and about what, you know, what she said. We know that we're in contact with extraterrestrials. That's what she said. She said, at one time, you know, I took her to see the movie E.T. And, you know, I figured I might be able to get her to talk a little bit more. And this time she wasn't talking quite as much, but what she said was, she said, well, it's a cute movie, son, but I don't think they're all that nice, quote unquote. Uh-oh. But then she would stop talking again. You know, it's like, God, you know, I really, really want to know. And, you know, it's like Barry Goldwater, you know, asking Curtis LeMay if he could go to the Blue Room. And he just said, you don't have a need to know. Forget it. Don't ask me again. You know, you know, this is they say that it's more highly classified than the atomic bomb. So me going to MUFON, I was watching a lot of UFO shows, and I was reading everything I could kind of get my hands on, and I had been doing that since I was a child, actually. and we were watching a Hangar One episode about 4.5 years ago, my wife and I. And I turned to her and I said, you know, I could do this. I mean, I could do this. So I went and I looked up MUFON. You know, I went to MUFON.com. I found my state director and I friended him on social media. And we started talking, and he actually brought it up to me. He said, I think you would make a really good field investigator. He liked the fact that I was a musician and that I was a musician that liked I like to jam, you know, to do that. You know, I'm kind of a jam musician where I'll come up with a guitar solo after hearing, like, say, the verse one time through. You know, you get the parameters of it, and then you just jump in. And you have to be thinking about what's going on, but you also have to be open to invention. And he said, I think you would make a really good field investigator. And you know, I'm chief investigator for MUFON in Southern California now, as well as a STAR team member and assistant state director. So I guess I sort of climbed up the ranks really quickly. And all I really did was, I closed a whole bunch of cases. You know, I guess I'm into the 400s now as far as the cases I've closed.
Wow.
So it just kind of opened up like a flower for me, and it's the greatest joy in my life. Really, it's right there with music. I get as much joy from closing a UFO case as I do from playing a gig. You know, mm-hmm. Same kind of feeling of accomplishment.
Uh-huh.
And,
Well, California, for one thing, is, in the United States, it's the highest number of UFO sightings. And, of course, the population is really high and the weather's really good. So there's a lot of reasons for that. It's also the number one state that listens to the show. You know, I have more listeners in California than and second comes New York. But I've noticed, you know, that there's a lot going on there. So can you talk about some of the cases that are kind of recent and unknown? And then I want to talk about what you think is the most compelling case as well.
Sure. Oh, that's going to be hard because I have a bunch of compelling cases. Well, you have to remember that it just like J. Allen Hynek told us that 90-95% of all UFO reports can figure them out prosaically, that they're usually, yeah. You know, and we get a lot of drone sightings. I had one gentleman who was seeing the same three UFOs in the sky every single night. And you know, all I had to do is go and open up a star chart. And yes, it was Venus and Mars and Jupiter, you know. and you know, you've got sometimes I'll actually get intentional hoaxes. I had one person who put in a case that was too good to be true. And I did a little investigation on them on the internet and found a public resume where it said CGI that looks realer than life, you know? And so I kind of, wow. It was pretty easy to figure that one out. But it's that 5% factor. Sometimes it's a little lower than that. Sometimes it's a little higher than that. But, you know, I've closed upwards to 400 cases, and I have about 35 to 40 cases that are unknowns in the last 4 years. But and most of them are kind of gobsmacking UFOs. I mean, I have to pull my chin up off of the floor sometimes with these.
Now, do you have some of them with multiple witnesses? And, you know,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, we have. I'll share a couple of cases with you, if you don't mind. It's probably the best way to do this. This was a recent case that we had. If I can get my iPad to work here.
You can kind of give an overall. You don't have to
sure. Yeah. Well, I had one. We had one recent case that happened in San Diego. And the gentleman that saw this was an aerospace engineer, and he was a veteran of aerospace engineering. He had been he'd worked for Boeing, and he worked with laser calibration of Rolls-Royce jet engines.
Mm.
And wow. Yeah, and the guy was also a bit of a plane spotter, and he knew his drones, his blimps from his UFOs, right? And he saw this thing that looked like a football. It had one tall black fin on the back. It didn't have like a blimp would have, you know, sort of like evenly placed fins on the back. But this thing was, it stood up, you know, like you took a, like a pie piece or something, and you put it on the back of this thing. He said that he could see the planes that were around it, and he said that he's very, very used to seeing, you know, checking distances with line of sight aircraft. And he said that as far as he could tell, this thing was the size of 4 737s.
Wow.
And he saw this thing. He said it was up about 35,000 feet, and that it suddenly dropped down to 5,000 feet. He said that he watched it. It wasn't like it disappeared and reappeared. He said it just dropped. And he said that the nose stayed level, that it, you know, it wasn't a crash. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, a plane or a blimp or whatever you want in distress, it's going to be all over the place. And it's certainly not going to keep level. But this stayed level. And he said then he watched the thing turn as if it was on an axis. He said now he is watching the back of it. You could still see this line in the back of this one black, you know, fin. And then it just, like nobody's business, just slowly moved towards the Baja Peninsula.
Wow.
Now, this was a really good witness. I did see his work badges. There was provenance behind it. The guy knew what he was talking about. When we talked about it, he was getting emotional. And he said, well, I don't really get emotional about aircraft. It's what I do, but this I can't explain. And his whole attitude was, he said, I want you to tell me what this was that I saw. You know, I don't really believe in UFOs. What did I see? Well, you know, I looked at, you know, illuminated blimps in the area. You know, there were the Goodyear blimp wasn't out there. And he said, well, it didn't look like, I know what a blimp looks like. This wasn't that. It was very, you know, it was bright, very bright, with this one black thing in the back. I kept his case open a little over, and finally I had to tell him. I said, I don't know what to tell you. I tried to debunk it as something prosaic and known, and there's no known object that goes from 35,000 feet to 5,000 feet, turns on its axis, and then just slowly flies off into the sunset. There's no such thing. And so you saw a UFO. It's an unidentified flying object. it was actually featured on the on San Diego Channel 8 News. They had Jan Harzan, our executive director for MUFON, on the news report. He actually shared the story on the news channel. But that was a new one. That's one of the more recent ones.
Before you move on from that one, there was a 19, and I may be totally off on this, but a 1978 UFO sighting in Canadian Royal Mounted Policeman saw an object that I believe had a tail like that. Just what you're explaining, I'm almost positive I'm recalling that there was some type of tail like a fin on the back of it, and very similar. So I'm going to check into that later, but I find that really – I love when there's two accounts that there's something similar.
There's another.
Far apart and, you know, credible.
Bruce McAbee actually contacted me and showed me in his FBI and UFOs book that he published – there was one blue book case back from 1948 that was very similar and looked very similar. And this was a multi-witness sighting, and they had binoculars and And it was one of the blue book cases that they couldn't explain. And it had a tall tail fin on it as well. So it's a thing, apparently.
Yeah, that is for the to have a tail on it is kind of bizarre if they, you know, wherever they're traveling from, why they would need one. Yeah, that's a good one. So how did this end? Is it just as one of the closed cases of an unknown? Is that basically what happens?
It's closed as an unknown. I've certainly been pushing it out there. It's been in the news, and I know that MUFON, our website, that was the featured case that, you know, if you'd go to MUFON.com for a couple of weeks, that was the main case that you would see. They kind of had the report up there where everybody could see it. And it's one of the, you know, it's one of the UFOs that are recent and contemporary that it means a lot to me. I can't explain it. It's a very strange one. And, you know, when I write my book, I am actually writing one. I'm sure that case will be in there, you know, along with the rest of the cases that I've closed as unknowns. There's some cases that I haven't been able to close as unknowns that I still think are really, really good. And when that happens, you know, if you don't have quite enough evidence or you don't have a second witness or I'll usually close that as insufficient data, which kind of keeps it open. And that way I can keep on gathering stuff, you know, because I'll add to my cases as time goes on. You know, especially with experiencer cases, I mean, there's always more visits that happen. So sometimes you'll get the evidence that you really want for a case a few years in. So that's one way that I handle my cases. But, you know, most of the cases, again, they're usually drones or Mylar balloons. You know, right. There's all kinds of stuff that people mistake for UFOs. And it can be a kind of a drag talking to the people that have seen something when, you know, and I've gotten to the point now where I'll open up the video and right away I kind of know what I'm looking at. You know,
sure.
That's a galaxy smartphone, you know, lens flare. You know, you'll get like this little blue ball with yellow lights around it. And
sure.
It looks technological. Well, it is technological, but it's from inside of your phone, you know.
Yeah.
That's why you didn't see it with your eyes, you know.
Right. Well, so when you're dealing with the people, you mentioned earlier that one of them was a hoax. Can you, or some of them were, can you explain what the hoaxes were that you basically figured out were hoaxes?
Oh, well, you know, we don't like it when we get those, but it's a part of this. And, you know, even, you know, Dr. Hynek himself, you know, I was listening to your show with the Hynek brothers. I've met Paul.
Oh, yeah.
And I've met both of them, actually, but I've kind of kept in touch with Paul a little bit. And I guess that their dad sort of, he loved the hoaxes at first. And he loved trying to figure out what the, you know, what people were mistaking for flying saucers. And you know, it's a part of what you do. If you're a serious field investigator, a serious UFO investigator, you're going to try to debunk your own cases. You're going to look at your case from every single side, because if you don't do it, somebody's going to do it for you.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
So you want to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my state director and my dear friend Jeff Krause, he does tend to overload my caseload, but I want that, you know, because I know I'm going to have to go through like, you know, 30 cases before I find something interesting. So I want all the balloons. I want the drones, because somewhere in there I'm going to find something with you know, multiple witnesses or a real, you know, a scientist or pilot or policeman that saw something that I can't explain, and that kind of makes my day.
Do you think that when you tell someone, hey, look, I can tell you right now this is a lens flare or this is a balloon, do you oftentimes get a sense of relief, or do you get people, you know, that feel like they want to argue the point?
Both.
Both. You get both.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, I mean, if somebody really wants to argue the point, I mean, I try to be sweet about it. I'm not going to sit there and make their UFO go away. You know, it's like this wasn't even a case. It was a sushi chef friend of mine, I order sushi from, and he and his daughter were out, and she was on his shoulders, and she points up and says, "What's that, Dad?" And he took the iPhone video, and it was a Mylar balloon. It really was. It was a Mylar balloon. It would spin around, and you get the flash from the sun. You know, it wasn't a blinking light. But this was a special moment between he and his daughter. And I wasn't going to sit there and tell him that it was, you know, no, you didn't see anything. You saw, you know, a balloon and forget about it. It wasn't even a case anyway. But I try to be nice. I don't try to, you know, bash people, you know, with reality. You know, now if somebody is trying to, if they have a movie deal or they're going to have a TV show about UFOs or something, or if it's a computer CGI hoax where they obviously were hoping to make us look foolish or to make the whole, the phenomena look foolish, I'm going to go after that a little heavier, you know. Right. It depends on what we're talking about. But some guy with his daughter on his shoulders that sees a Mylar balloon, I'll pretty much leave it at, well, you know, I think that might be a balloon, but I don't know. I mean, you know, that might have been a UFO. And I'll kind of try to let them keep their sense of wonder. You know, next time they might actually see a real one, you know.
Right. You don't want them to stop looking. You know, going back to, I mentioned earlier, so I was just looking while you were speaking here. I mentioned the football-shaped, you know, UFO with a fin on the back, and I just found this. So this was 1978, Clarenville. This was Canada, and it was a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer named Jim Blackwood. So anyone can check that out if you Google that. You'll see that that object was actually football-shaped with a fin on the back, like what you're talking about. So that. I love that stuff when they connect a similar object.
Oh yeah, well I always look for that. You know, I had another recent case where, this one I really loved actually. I've had a lot of good ones lately. You know, I've had a lot of aerospace people coming forward.
Wow.
There was one case. I'm just going to bring it up here. There were three guys that were out fishing. They were on a fishing trip. They were out near Sequoia National Park area, near where Lemoore Air Force Base is. And it was about 2 in the morning. They had been drinking some beer early in the evening, but now they were done drinking beer. It had been many hours, you know, hence, you know, because I did ask him about that. He said, no, we weren't drunk. You know, we hadn't been drinking in about 6 hours at this point. But they were just kind of driving around. They were looking for an impromptu campsite. And they were hovered over by this strange object. It started as a pinpoint of light, and it kept on getting closer. They turned off their car. They're sitting in there. The guy was smoking a cigarette. He put his cigarette out. He was looking out the window. And the way they described this was it looked like a pie wedge. It was black, pitch black, flat black. Just, I believe there was only one external light, and that was in the middle. It would flash on and flash off. This thing kept on getting closer to them, and they were sort of secreted off to the side near the side of a cliff. And he felt like perhaps they hadn't been observed. But this thing was hanging really close to them, and it got a little closer to them and a little closer. And he said it was about the size of a school bus. It was pie wedge shaped. And the strange thing about it is that it was traveling blunt edge forward, and mm-hmm. the little tip of the pie piece was in the back.
That's something I've heard before too.
No aerodynamics involved here.
right.
The guys were feeling scared, and the car was off, and they were hiding in their car. They were hiding under the seats. They felt the hair go up on their arms as they were watching this thing. They could hear a hum when it got closer to them. And anyhow, this thing hung over them for about 5-10 minutes. When it took off, it left a 45-degree angle. And they were close enough to it that they could see as it left, it had a tracer image of itself that it left in its wake, sort of like the bioluminescence that you'll see behind a ship. And I've had other cases that the same property of a UFO leaving had the same effect, to where you would see the tracer image of it. And I thought that was really, really interesting.
We are late for a break, so we're going to take a break now. Hang in, everyone. My guest is Earl Gray, and we'll be right back right after these messages. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and my guest is Earl Gray from Southern California. And we at the end of the last segment there, you were pretty much wrapped up that sighting, didn't you? The pie-shaped thing and all that.
That was one of mine. That was classified as an unknown aerial vehicle. You know, that was. There's nothing else that looks like a pie that does that. And it scared the guys. I mean, they were scared that they were going to be abducted or something, so they were hiding behind the seats. And but what really struck me, now, you know, it's like when we look at when we get a UFO case, you know, you want multiple witnesses, you want to have some kind of evidence or some kind of corroborating factor where you can, if you're going to give it an unknown, that'll allow that unknown to stand until, you know, unless somebody else can disprove it. And with that particular case, what really struck me was that when it left, it was hanging directly over their car, and it took off at an angle, and they could see a tracer image of this thing, the pie wedge shape, that kept on going into the distance, and it hung there in the sky, sort of the way that you'll see bioluminescence go behind in the wake of a ship. Mm-hmm. And immediately, it brought to mind another case that I had, where it was a historic sighting from 1965 by this gentleman that had sat on his story for years. But it had happened in Venice, California, and I was a kid living in Venice when this guy had the sighting, just like a couple of blocks away, which I thought was really, really interesting. You know, I was a child and he was a teenager, but he was with a friend and they had been at a dance at the Mormon church. The guy was a Mormon and was at the Mormon church, right, for a dance, hoping to meet a pretty girl. And instead, they wound up hanging out afterwards, and he and his friend saw a UFO. And it was the same kind of a situation where their car was parked there, the UFO was hovering, and it left again at an angle from directly over him off into the distance. And he talked about the exact same phenomenon, where there was a tracer image of this thing, where, you know, when it took off, you could see it, but repeated, and it kept on getting smaller into the vanishing point. And I've heard that same, I've heard it expressed exactly the same in a couple of other cases as well. So with that case, I was able to go back and find that earlier, computer management system case that I'd gotten through MUFON. I went back in the files, and I was able to reiterate his sighting and corroborate this more recent sighting because of that same effect, you know, the tracer effect that they have. And personally, you know, that's the kind of thing that I'm looking for in my investigations and my adventures, you know, with this most most extraordinary phenomenon, is those repeated patterns.
Now, you've probably been, or I'm sure MUFON's been contacted a lot from failed missile launches or just plain missile launches, rocket launches, things.
Yeah, well, our good friend Elon Musk and SpaceX, you know, if there is a SpaceX launch from Vandenberg, I know I'm going to get about 10 new cases, you know.
Okay, well, that's interesting. So what about some cases? Are there any ones that come to mind that involve electronics failing and vehicles, things like that? Any of those cases happen there?
Well, sure, that's definitely a thing. You know, I mean, I had a recent case where it could have caused that, but the guys that were that were the witnesses, they had seen close encounters of the third kind, so they turned their car off, you know, which was probably a smart thing. Because as a lot of us know, you know, UFOs can cause an EMP, and it can stop your engine. It can even mess your engine up. So I'm trying to think if I've had any cases where, I mean, I've had plenty of cases where, okay, I've got one. I just thought of one. There was one sighting that was over Hollywood, California. This was about a year and a half ago. And it was a flying saucer. These guys were watching this thing, and the guy went for his iPhone. Both he and his girlfriend, they said that their iPhones were charged, and I talked with them. They pulled the iPhones out, and there was zero charge. And you hear that a lot. I think that right. if you're close enough to a UFO. If you think of taking a photograph or a video, and oftentimes people don't, you know, I mean, I've had an anomalous sighting before. The last thing that came to my mind was going for my iPhone. And I don't know if it's some psychological effect that our visitors are, you know, putting upon us. But that's a thing. People just forget that there's such a thing as a photograph or a video. So I think that, and I've thought about that a lot, Martin. I've wondered about it, and I thought it was a problem at one time, and now I don't think it's such a problem. I think that our visitors are well aware that they're. Hold on one second. I just kicked my earphone microphone out there.
Yeah,
I think that I've gotten to the point where I don't think there's really such a thing as a random sighting. I think that we're being shown stuff. I think that it's for our benefit. I think that it's intentional that they're being seen. Otherwise, why not cloak all the time? I have so many UFO sightings where it goes in and out, you know, blinks into existence,
right.
And then it's almost like a cloaking field comes back in. I think that it's an intentional thing that they're just like slowly. They want us to know that they're there. There was a famous UFO sighting. It was called the Eagle River UFO, where this guy saw a flying saucer. It came down, and these guys had more or less an ET hibachi in there. Right? They asked him to go get them some pure water. They wanted pure water, right? So he went. He got some water from the well. He brought it back, and they proceeded to cook him buckwheat pancakes in their UFO.
Oh, that one! Yeah, I remember that one.
It's absurd.
That is so far out there that it's almost has to be believable.
But they. There was a quote from the entity. The entity said, "We want you to believe in us, but not that much." And then they took off. And I sort of think, you know, at that, I keep on returning to that, and I mention that story a lot because I see something there that I think that, you know, they want this to be seeping into our culture, seeping into our lives, that we aren't alone. And maybe that's why people didn't really react to the Tic Tac UFO story so much when it came up in the New York Times. You know, people have just sort of been inundated with this, and they kind of take it for granted now. It's like, well, so what? Yeah, sure, we know this is real. You know, 70% of the people out there now pretty much believe that the phenomenon is at least there's something to it. You know. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is kind of what they've worked towards, you know, for however many years, or the many, many, many years that people have had anomalous sightings. But they want us to believe in them, but not that much.
Wow. So, I think it's interesting. And it also brings up the point where, why would they have lights? You know, maybe they have lights because they want us to see them as well. And,
duh.
And you know, it's funny that I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, the dinner guest that I spoke with last night mentioned, you know, her three encounters, and two of them did just what you're saying. They vanished. Like, she shot up and blink, they were gone, just like that. And that is also pretty bizarre. Almost makes you wonder, you know, what that's about, if it's cloaking or another dimension or what the heck it's all about. Yeah. Fascinating, though.
It's you know, it's like Arthur C. Clarke said that any significantly advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I think that that's kind of what we're dealing with, that they're not gods. But you know, if you'd taken somebody from 300 years ago and Da Vinci, you know, and put him into our culture and showed him an iPhone, he would be baffled. He would think it was, right. You know, I mean, it's the same thing with us. So, right.
And that's just a short time in the scope of things for such a giant leap of technology. And you just can't even imagine what that's like if you add a million years to what we are now. And then again, it's always whether we can make it through without blowing ourselves up, you know, and keep going.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Technology we get.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it's possible that some of the things that people are seeing are maybe even us from the future. I don't think that it's just one thing that's happening on Earth.
Yeah. There's a lot of speculation about that.
You go back to the old, you know, late 1800s airship sightings, and or you can go back to Ezekiel's wheel in the Bible, you know.
Yeah, wheel within a wheel, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Sanskrit, I mean, in India, I mean, there's a lot of Sanskrit writings from 5,000 years ago, even, that sounds very, very compelling.
Yeah. Right, right. So let's talk about some of the other intriguing cases that you've been working on, or have closed already. You know, long closed.
Well, I had one that's a really interesting one, and it was actually we you know, MUFON puts out this UFO cases of interest book, and this one was in that book. It had happened out in Azusa, California, which is a few miles from where I live here, about 30 miles away, and two women saw this strange light that was hovering over the mountain range, and it was doing what they call the falling leaf motion, where it was two lights that were kind of going up and down next to each other. The one woman had had she had actually had quite an extraordinary sighting back in her youth. The other woman was not really into UFOs, but the woman who was said, let's get in the car, let's go, let's see if we can get there, you know. And they went chasing across downtown Azusa. I like to think of it as a car chase, but it wasn't like they were actually chasing it through Azusa, unfortunately. It would be a better story if they had been, but they got there as fast as they could, and they got caught in a cul-de-sac near this park. They stopped the car, and they were trying to figure out how they could get closer to the mountain range. And the mountain range where this was happening is an old, they say that it's a decommissioned torpedo base, which is interesting. It's in the mountains, you know, but there's a reservoir. Yeah. There's a reservoir that's there. There's also, you know, mining for exotic metals in the area. And that whole area has been taken. It was bought over by the federal government back about 7 years, 8 years ago. So you can only get so close to where they were watching these two objects hovering. Anyhow, they were sitting in their car watching the falling leaf motion of this thing when there was a light off to the right-hand side. And they turned around, and the two women saw a flying saucer. The thing was about 35 feet across. It had four or five very delineated lights that were under it. It was lighting the house that was underneath the object. Again, this thing would blink in and out. It's like it had some sort of camouflage that was either not working properly or purposefully wasn't working so that they could see it. So, I mean, they put the report in. I got a hold of them the next day. I went out to the site 2 days later, and I interviewed both women. I talked to the gentleman that owned the house, and he was a very religious man, and he really didn't want to have anything to do with it. It was pretty much get off of my lawn, is what he was saying to me.
Wow.
I pretty much, you know, I went to all the houses around his, and I talked to people, gave him my cards, and unfortunately this happened right around the dinner hour, so people weren't out on their porches, they weren't anywhere where they could have seen this. Thankfully, there was a guy that lived in the town about 5 miles over, and he watched the two objects by the hill leaving. He described the exact same thing. He didn't see the flying saucer, but he saw the two objects over the hill. He saw them leaving that town. So we do have one unconnected witness to this case. We have the two women who their story has remained the same over the last year and a half since their sighting happened. And I'm you know, in constant contact with both of them. And neither of them have any reason to make some crazy story up like this. Mm-hmm. So to me, that was one of the better sightings that we've had. Just more or less usually refer to it as the Azusa UFO. But that was a really, really good sighting. I mean, it was three different objects that they were watching. And you have to wonder, well, why did this appear to these women? Well, they went chasing after trying to find the UFO, and they couldn't quite get there. And my feeling and their feeling as well was, well, maybe it turned around and it went and found them. Yeah. And then that's sort of the nature of the phenomena. You know, this is what I have found, that I believe it's an interactive phenomena. It's well aware of us. There's technologies that we can't even begin to understand. And if you have an interest, I think that it probably has an interest in you, you know, it probably has an interest in you. So these ladies were, I think they were being shown something, you know?
Yeah, that's really an interesting one. There's also, you know, I've mentioned this a number of times on the show. It's also, I think it's very interesting that a lot of times people will have the same sighting of a sighting of the same whatever it is, craft or whatever it is, many days, either many days in a row, or, you know, it just makes you wonder why something would stay regional. Why, you know, if it's actually coming here from a different area, a different, say, planet or dimension or wherever it's coming from, why wouldn't it do more exploring? You know, go across the landscape or from one country to another country. Very rarely do you hear that. I mean, you do hear that, yes, but a lot of times it'll show up in the same place, you know, a day or two later, and just doesn't make any sense.
You don't really get reports like you used to get back in the 1950s where, oh, well, they were taking soil samples or they're collecting fauna. And my guess is this has probably been going on for a long, long time. You know, I this is just hypothesis on my part, but I think that the phenomena has been with us forever. You know, Jacques Vallée talks about this. You know, he talks about the, you know, fairies and leprechauns and the weirdness that's, you know, seems to have always been tagging planet Earth, you know, and society. And of course, Jacques Vallée believes that the UFO phenomenon is probably a part of this, that and I don't think that it's necessarily an extraterrestrial phenomenon. I think that it's an outer space phenomenon. I think that it could be dimensional as much as it's from a distant star system, you know, that it's all outer space to me. I mean, it really is. Time and space are interconnected. And I think that our visitors are coming from all different points. It's not just one thing that's going on.
And what's your opinion on what the government may or may not know about this phenomenon?
I think that they are well aware that there is a phenomenon that I know, just because of my mom and the multiple FOIA requests that people have been able to put in that you know, we know that the government's very, very interested in it. You know, some people, you hear a lot about secret societies and that you know, they're the secret space program. And I think that, you know, that we do have a secret space program. Certainly we do. You know, I mean, the SR-71 Blackbird was kept secret for many, many years. And that thing still looks like a, you know, Buck Rogers, for God's sake. Looks right. More futuristic than anything that we have right now, really. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's some of that going on. But as far as why our visitors are here, I don't know that the government really is in the know about it. I think that there's a lot of worry that people are going to start asking them too many questions and they won't be able to answer them. I mean, they can't say that they can protect us from them, that's for sure.
Right.
Something that can blink in and out of existence, or you know, the camouflage caused it to, you know, it's like, you know, Frodo Baggins' invisibility cloak. You know, it's the same kind of thing. You can't really fight something that you can't see, that doesn't leave a radar track, you know. And so I think that probably plays in there, is that, you know, it's why it is a national security threat. It makes them look stupid, is what it does.
Yeah, they have no control.
They have no control over it. Zero. Yeah.
I think that's interesting, and I agree. Basically, that's kind of my thoughts on the situation. Not that I know any more than anyone else, but the fact that they probably don't really know. They know something's going on, but, you know, and then, you know, people talk about crashed saucers and retrievals and all that, and you know, if that is really so, then, you know, maybe they know a little more, or some part of the government knows a little more, or did. Maybe they don't anymore, or a private part.
I think, you know, they've got crash materials. I'm sure they do. You know, I know the Marcel family. They're, you know, Denise Marcel is a very close personal friend, and I talked to Jesse Jr., you know. Oh, you know, I talk with them a lot, you know, that's not just a story. I mean, their grandfather came home with his trunk filled with memory metal. And my dear friend, Dr. Irina Scott, she worked at Battelle Institute, and there were reports that came out of there that you know, kind of corroborate that whole story, that, you know, that there was a crash. The materials that they found were light as a feather, and if you would crunch them up, scrunch them up, they would go right back to their original you know, shape, like there was, you know, electrostatic element to that metal to where it would go back to its original shape. You could hit it with a sledgehammer or shoot bullets at it, and it nothing would happen, you know. And
you know, when you say that this is also something that almost doesn't make sense. So it does all that, but yet it burst into pieces. So how did that happen, you know?
I don't know. You know, I mean, there's a part of me that wonders if maybe that was, you know, intentional. Maybe they were giving us something there. You know, maybe they wanted us to have the technology. I think there's kind of a hands-off policy with us to a point. It's obviously not hands off. I mean, I do believe that there. I do believe that people are abducted by aliens. I think that they're doing tests on us. That they are maybe interested in our DNA. You know, I am a member of MUFON's Experiencer research team, and I talk to many abductees and visitees, and you hear the same stories over and over. And some people love their aliens. Some of them hate their aliens, but you know, it sounds like something is going on there, and that you know, I mean, there's a lot of different elements to this phenomenon, and it's ongoing. It's ongoing.
You know, I've said a number of times. Sometimes I feel like on the fence on that whole thing. What is the most convincing part of it to you? Is it that you hear the same story or a similar story from different people?
Yes. Right there. I mean, I have people from all walks of life. I have scientists I talk with. I have artists that I speak with. You hear the same stories over and over and over again. And I feel like if you take an interest in our visitors, I mean, I think that it's interconnected. You know, it's like what I was saying earlier, that if you're interested in ET, they're interested in you. I think that there's sort of like a joint thing that happens between the abductees or visitees and our visitors, you know. But you hear the same stories over and over again, and you hear about people going into a hypnagogic state. You hear about the Oz effect taking place, where it gets very, very, very quiet. You hear the same stories over and over again. People with implants, they've been medically examined. I know that, you know, the Two of the Stars guys that you were talking about earlier, that apparently... Apparently, Robert Bigelow does have materials. The Experiencer research team that I work for, that they have materials. I mean, they've gathered implants from people. I know one gentleman who I talk with pretty regularly. He's become a friend. He was never a MUFON case. He was just somebody I met at a MUFON meeting, and we've kept in touch. But he keeps on going back and having implants taken out of his foot, and they keep returning. He's had them checked out before, and you keep on hearing about these, you know, the metallurgy of the devices had to have been created in a zero gravity environment, which is not something that we can do yet, as far as we know, anyway. Why are they putting these tracking objects in us, you know? Now, it brings to mind to me, I'm a bit of a zoo hypothesis in a way, because I feel like there's a hands-off policy to a point. You know, we want you to believe in us, but not that much. But yet there's this continual interaction, you know? But they want to have the plausible deniability there in place. And there's always some crazy aspect to these cases, you know, that almost makes them laughable. You feel embarrassed to tell your own story out there because it's so absurd. But you know, it's just like if you have a wild animal park, you're going to go in there and you're going to check up on your animals every now and then. You're going to tranquilize them. You're going to track them. And they do know that you're there, but they don't want the animals to think that you're there that much, right? You know, and maybe the prime directive from Star Trek is the best example of that. So I believe that we are being visited. I know we're being visited, you know. I've had strange occurrences in my own life, you know. And I'll tell you this. Since I began as a MUFON field investigator, I've had a string of synchronicities in my life. Just coincidences that are meaningful, that keep on taking place over and over and over again. In my life before I was doing this so, you know, hands-on, every once in a while you'd have a meaningful coincidence that would happen. You know, I would have a meaningful coincidence. But now it's sort of like the second nature of my life. And that is new. That's been going on for 4 years. It didn't happen before then. So, you know, I do believe that we're being interacted with, and I think that if you're interested in them and you're studying them and you're trying to understand it, that it's going to amplify that. It's going to happen in your own life. And take me up on that out there, you know. If you really, 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 you know, spend some time and energy and try to figure this out, and try to understand what's happening on Earth, I'm willing to bet you're going to have some strange, meaningful coincidences taking place in your life. You'll see it. And you know, write them down, keep them in a little logbook. Cause I do, you know, and I mean, it's gotten to the point now where I just sort of go, yeah, they're again, you know, it's a thing. So what it all means, I'm not sure, you know, what their final, you know, I think that, I'm not sure. I don't think that it's a malevolent phenomenon. I don't think that it's necessarily a benevolent phenomenon either. I think that it's just like us, but it's just more advanced than we are. But if you draw close to it, it'll draw close to you. I'll guarantee you that.
Someone in chat wanted to know what your thoughts are as far as things running in a family.
Yes. Seems to have a familial thing to it. My mom, when she was a child, she had a strange encounter with, she called it ball lightning. But I've talked about her experience with a few scientists, and they, you know, people say, well, ball lightning can last about 5-6 seconds max. My mom talked about when she was a little girl, she was growing up in Iowa, Muscatine, Iowa, and she and her sister would sleep on the they had a screened in porch that they would sleep in. And one night my mom heard this buzzing sound. She was falling asleep and she heard this loud buzzing sound. She got up, she sat up, she had her pillows there, and she said that there was this ball of sparks, that it sounded like a hive of bees. And that she watched this thing come through the screen door. She said it like squeezed right through and it retained its shape. It was about basketball sized.
Wow.
And it came into their porch area. It hovered over her sister, just hovered there for a little while. It came back to my mom and hovered near her again. And then it pushed back out through the screen. My mom said that she got up out of the little bedroll that she had set up, and she actually chased this ball of sparks across a cornfield. And it was about 30 to 40 feet above her when it had just stopped there. And it was hanging there in the sky. And she said that she got under this thing. She said it smelled like an electric train, which is ozone. You know?
Right.
She smelled, yeah, you know, as electricity. And she said that it literally went pop and it was gone. Now, my mom talked about this story. Her sister talked about it as I was growing up. I know our whole family heard about this story. But there's other people that have had the same experience, this ball lightning effect. I'm going to bring up my friend Dr. Irina Scott again, that she and her sister had a similar event happen when they were little girls. It was smaller. It was like ping pong ball sized. It came into their room. It was spinning around their light. Both of them remember this. You don't share hallucinations, right? They both were awake and alert, and they saw this. It was like observing them. It left their house, but it left them with this big question mark in their lives. And Irina went on to work for the DIA. She worked for Battelle Institute, who may have actually gotten the Roswell wreckage. Battelle, they figure out the metallurgy of foreign properties of objects that, if you get like in the World War II, if you got a Japanese Zero that came down and there was some strange metal in it that we didn't understand, that's where it would go. So, but there are many, many people that have this similar story to my mom's story. And it sounds like we're being observed. It sounds like we're being watched. I would call that a probe of some sort. Yeah.
Wow. Someone in chat wanted you to talk about the most interesting experience or case that you can think of.
I had one case. The gentleman who reported it to us did not go anonymous with it, so I can actually mention him. His name's Jeff Edgman. And he was, it's a historic case. It happened back in 1992. But he and his family, he'd had a newborn son about a month before. And they were going to take their little baby to meet the relatives. They lived in Bakersfield. So they were driving, and it was late in the evening, and they pulled the car. Jeff pulled the car over. He had to take a little bathroom break in nature's bathroom, right? But he and his wife were out there. He was actually out there, and he asked his wife to come out. He said, "Hey, honey, come here. Check this out." She comes out and they're watching. There were just these really, really bright stars that were above them. And it just was unnaturally bright. And they're just, they thought maybe it was just because they were out in the desert. They were near China Lake area. So they're looking at the sky and the stars start moving around. They're like going all kinds of different directions. It's like, what is it like? Some secret program? Are these satellites? They watched them literally fall from the sky. It's like in a circle around them and came down to the desert floor. At this point, Jeff noticed there's this red ball of light that's in the weeds off to the right side, just off of the road. And it's like he told me, he said that it was almost like the way that you would play with a kitten with a laser pointer. I feel like they were trying to distract me from what else was going on. So he was trying to follow this ball of light that kept on moving around and moving around. It was just got very strange. He said that it became quiet. You couldn't hear crickets chirping. You couldn't hear sounds. It became like muffled. Like a cone of silence from Get Smart, which is the thing. Anyhow, Jeff then he said that his wife had been to the left of him. Suddenly she wasn't there. He hears her voice way behind him on the other side of the street. And he said, the way he described it, he said it was like my wife's voice, but it wasn't her voice. And she said, "They aren't going to hurt us. Don't worry."
Wow.
At this point, I for some reason, I keep on bringing up flying saucers today with you, Martin, but I guess that's just the tone of the day. He saw a disc that was hovering about 4 or 5 feet over the ground, come skimming over the desert floor. And he was just, he said he nearly peed his pants. Now, this is a oil worker guy. Looks like Bruce Springsteen. He's no nonsense, you know, no funny business about this guy whatsoever. And he watched this thing just race past him. He said that he could see the moon reflected in the side, that it was like a chromed saucer. And suddenly his memories just go blank at that point. Now, it was about 8 hours later that he and his wife came to, is the word that he used, but they were standing up. They were leaning up against the bumper of the car. The sun was up. They're like trying to figure out what had happened, but they're not really talking about it. They're feeling embarrassed. It's almost like somebody told them, don't talk about this. They got back into the car. The three children were still in the car. The baby was in the car seat. The two older boys were asleep. Like it was 8 o'clock in the morning, they were still asleep. And they got in the car. They kept on driving, and they drove to the relative's house 8 hours later than they were supposed to be there. Neither of them felt like they were supposed to talk about it. When Jeff started talking about it a little bit, you know, like months later, she was very uncomfortable with talking about it. And it eventually wound up causing a rift in their marriage. It was a problem for her to bring it up.
Wow.
And that's one of my favorite cases. That was actually the first unknown that I ever closed for MUFON. And I'm very, very proud of that case. We were able to, you know, as far as evidence went, the date that it happened and he remembered the shape of the moon that he saw reflected in the side of the flying saucer. And it was exactly as, you know, Farmer's Almanac said it was. It was like a quarter moon, a little to the waxing side. You know, it was just a wonderful case every direction I looked at it. And it's still a good case. And it's still an open for me. I mean, I closed it as an unknown, but I keep in touch with Jeff. And I think that as far as the cases that I've closed, it's not a recent one, but it's one that I think about a lot. And that 8 hours is very interesting.
Yeah, that's really a great one. So where is your the region that you actually work in? Does it just go up to a certain area in Southern California? Can you kind of give us a geography, the geography of where you do your investigations?
I have from San Diego out to Central California, a little past San Luis Obispo, where my boss lives, where Jeff Krause, my state director and friend, lives. And then up Northern California. We kind of split the state because it's such a huge state. So my friend Ruben Uriarte is state director of Northern California. And so they have a wonderful team there. California, I mean, we have two of the best MUFON teams that I know of. You know, I'm very, very proud of those, you know, of the guys up north as I am of our own field investigators out here. Between the two groups, I think that we've got California pretty well covered.
Right. Now, are there any cases that you're aware of that there was actually multiple states involved? In other words, California, say, something drifted into, you know, Utah or Arizona or other connecting states?
Well, it would have been Utah because that's
Nevada.
Well, yeah, sure. Well, we had one case that I closed recently, and it was actually another unknown. It was another aerospace gentleman, and it was another case of where these guys were on a fishing trip. You know, I guess if you want to meet ET, go fishing. You know, stay out late. You know, it was like 2 or 3 in the morning. And it was himself and his friend and his friend's girlfriend. And they saw an object that was coming from the direction of, he mentioned, you know, it could have been coming from Area 51. And that's Nevada. It's 300 miles away from where he was. So I don't know if that's where it was coming from. But that's the only case I could think of. But this was another case where these guys saw something that looked like a pair of wraparound sunglasses. It was 500 feet across.
Yeah.
And it was tiered. You could see multiple decks on this thing and people walking across. And again, you know, it was the same kind of, you know, once it was directly over them, they felt a hum that seemed to make their hair stand up. It made them feel uncomfortable. And it kept on traveling off towards the ocean. And so if he was correct, if that was coming from Nevada in that direction, then I guess that would have crossed state lines. Other than that one, I can't think of anything that comes to mind immediately, except perhaps the UFO we were talking about earlier in the show that was heading towards the Baja coast. That would have actually gone into Mexico. Yeah.
Right. That's interesting. You're talking about the I guess it sounds like it could be electromagnetics or something. You know, the static situation. That's Now what about triangle UFOs?
Get lots of those.
Yeah.
Lots of those.
Would you say that's a dominating factor, or, you know, 50-50 as far as the shapes go? I know there's always the lights in the sky, you know, as separated from that.
People see a lot of, right now, I mean, the main thing people see are spheres or orbs. Right behind it are disks and triangles. And then you've got, you know, diamond-shaped objects and elsewhere. My guess is that we're being, like I was saying earlier, I don't think it's just one thing that's going on. I think some of the UFOs are ours. Just like people would see the X-15 or they would see the SR-71 and they would mistake it for a UFO. Sure. You know, some of these things are our own objects, our own black projects.
Yeah.
I think it's very, very, you know, very possible that we've figured out anti-gravity or at least some of that. And the black triangles, I keep on... You know, and I know people are going to fight with me about this, and dear friends are going to fight with me about it, but I think that they look like they are coming out of a factory. They're all the same shape. They have the three lights on the edges. They have the one red light in the center. And whereas the stranger UFOs, they don't really look like they came out of a factory. They seem to shape-shift more They really don't have that manufactured look to them. But the black triangles seem to have sort of a manufactured look to them. So I oftentimes think that those are probably ours.
Well, I would almost agree with you on that. But there's been so many early sightings that are describing exactly, you know, the same thing or extremely close to it.
Yes.
You know, all the way back into the 70s, and I just can't imagine that they would have something like that in the 70s that would never be exposed by now.
Well, look
or used by now.
Look at the Russian space program. They came up with a lunar module that looked almost exactly like ours. They had a prototype of a space shuttle that looked almost exactly like our space shuttle. And so perhaps we're maybe copying that which we've seen. You know, we may be copying something that's not from here. That's what I think is probably going on, is that it's a human version of something that isn't human.
Hmm. And, you know, we talked earlier about To the Stars, and one of their mission statements is to try to figure out, you know, propulsion or, you know, try to replicate alien technology, if that's what it is, by observation. And I don't understand exactly how that would work. You have any thoughts on that and on that statement by them?
Well, you know, the parts of this phenomena that you can get under a microscope and that you can figure out, go for it. You know, I mean, it seems like this phenomena is science with fuzzy edges, and sometimes it acts a little bit like the paranormal phenomenon. And I think that it's not so much paranormal as is that we just need to expand our idea of what normal is, probably. Mm. You know, if you look at the old the physics experiment with the two slits, you know, where is it a wave or a particle?
Yeah.
It's no stranger than that, if you think about it. You know, Einstein sort of recoiled at the idea that God would play dice with the universe, but it seems like God just playing dice with the universe, you know? So there's a part of this phenomena that we can certainly pinpoint down and that we can explain scientifically, I think. And I think there's also going to be a part of it that's always probably going to evade us. Mm. Until at least we attain that level that our visitors have attained, and hopefully we will. And I'm all for what To the Stars is doing, and Robert Bigelow and all those guys. If they can approach this scientifically, and if they can figure out how to replicate it, go for it. You know, it's just please share it with the public. Don't
exactly.
Yeah.
And— yeah, I'm hoping for that too, because otherwise, conspiracies will start, for one thing.
Well, it's all the Illuminati,
Yeah.
Which I don't think it is. I mean, please don't quote me saying that, because I think that we probably have figured some things out. My mom certainly hinted at that while I was growing up. But I don't think that we're at the level of our visitors by a long shot. You know, they're probably, millions of years ahead of us, So it's going to seem like magic to us. I mean, it is, any sufficiently advanced technology, it's indistinguishable from magic for us. And so here we are, we're like Galileo being, Galileo, 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 let me go, hand him an iPhone, It's Galileo is really smart, or Da Vinci, you look at all of his stuff. But if you had handed him, an iPhone or my iMac or whatever, my MacBook, he would have thought that it was supernatural. Witchcraft is involved, it's voodoo. Then they call advanced physics voodoo physics, There's a reason why that nomaker is on there. It does seem like voodoo to us, but it's just advanced technology is what we're observing with UFOs, I believe.
Right.
When it's not a misidentified natural phenomena, like a sun dog or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we are at the end. And so I want to thank you so much for being our guest tonight.
Thank you, Martin. It was a pleasure. We just brushed the surface of this. So if you ever come back, I'd love to come back. We didn't even talk about MUFON's experience or research team that I'm working for. I'm working with Kathleen Martin and George Medic and some of the guys who are tip of the spear as far as the experiencer phenomenon goes. And that is just so interesting to me.
Yeah, it's great. Well, thanks again. It was great.
Thank you, Martin.
All right, take care.
You too.
Yeah, bye. All right, everyone, so that's it for the show. Thank you so much for watching and listening. And I also want to give a shout-out to Dave Dixon. Thanks so much for your strong support. And we'll be back next week with Kevin Day, and MJ Benias will be on as well. And I want to thank you all again for hanging in with us, and we'll be back to the studio next week. All right, everyone, so remember to keep your eyes to the sky.